This is Vonda Ann McIntyre, and you're listening to the SF Signal podcast.
SF Signal, episode 23. Is social media good for the book industry, publishing, and authors in general? And then after the break, we've got an interview with Gail Carriger. Stick around. This is a good one, folks. This is the SF Signal podcast, as powered by the Functional Nerds. This is episode number 23. My name is Patrick Hester, and I am an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And tonight, I'm joined by the folks who bring us SF Signal each and every week. Let's go down the list here. We have Jay Garman, Jeff Patterson, and Jessica Strider. We also have Larry Ketchersid joining us. Jay, why don't you go ahead and say hello?
Hello. I'm Jay Garman. I'm an internet entrepreneur by day, a blogger by night at jgarman.net. And when I can find the time, I show up on SF Signal.
And I have seen the uniform of the online entrepreneur, and I have to say I like the cape. Jessica, say hello.
Hi, I'm Jessica Strider. I blog at scififanletter.blogspot.com.
And then Mr. Jeff Patterson.
Hi, Jeff Patterson. I blog at Gravity Lens, which can be found at baddaystudio.com.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, Patrick. How are you?
Good. Why don't you tell everybody who you are?
I'm Larry Ketchersid. I'm sad that John DiNardo's not here, so we can't all give him grief about bagels and wanting books out of his book collection.
Yes, John's got some stuff going on and can't be with us tonight. Oh, well. We'll soldier on without him.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about the topic for tonight. What I threw out there for these folks, and hopefully they've done their research and are ready. And Larry is wrestling his microphone. Is social media good for the book industry, publishing, and authors? With Twitter and Facebook, publisher, author, and fan are more connected than ever before. Is this instant communication good for everyone, or has it become a distraction? Are the days of the anonymous author gone forever? Jay, what's your take on this?
I think it is a net gain for the industry, in particular the mid-list author. I think the days of the anonymous mid-list author are gone, which is better than saying that the mid-list author is gone, which is what we were saying as recently as 5 years ago, that there wouldn't be any of those anymore. I think that these tools have made it easier for the author that has to really hustle and do his own promotion or do her own sort of media coordination. It's gotten cheaper. It's gotten easier. There's nothing better than going and shaking a bookseller's hand. But when you can't fly all over the country on your own dime to do that, social media makes the next best thing accessible, possible, and affordable. So I think that's a great thing. And as ebooks become more and more the prevailing medium of the mid-list novel, and you can buy them directly, the device you're using to surf Twitter will also be the device you read your ebook on, and that barrier is going to drop, and it's going to get even better for the mid-listers. Mm-hmm. Stephen King doesn't have to be on Twitter, but, you know, I would think maybe Peter David does.
Very cool. And for the benefit of our listeners, I just want to say thank you for figuring out your microphone problem.
The problem is very simple. Throw away the microphone and use the ambient. That microphone had gotten thanks to some nefarious felines chewing through the cord.
I find that difficult to believe. I've never known a cat to do anything like that. So that's just
not there. Because Jay, I feel your pain. I feel your pain.
Jessica, I know you're dying to tell us. Go.
I agree that the book industry and the publishers are doing extremely well with social media. I think when it comes to authors, it depends on the author. Some authors do really well with it. They tend to have a balance between promotional posts versus other things that they find on the internet that are interesting or discussions that they have with people. I think it can go bad if you have an author who does not have a very good public personality, if they're not people. Like Elizabeth Moon had her political blog post that turned off a lot of readers. Also, a lot of self-published authors and newbie authors tend to spam you with stuff. They'll go on a chat room, and instead of actually being part of the community, they'll just say, "Hi, I'm a new author. I've got this book. Please read it," which turns off a lot of readers.
What about when you talk about the folks who are a little bit more shy? I want to say, you also had authors who are more used to being anonymous. It's like they sit in their little room, they write their books, they send them to the publisher publishes them. They never actually go out into the public. I think that's kind of dead now.
Right. But I don't think it's so much a matter of being shy, so much as a matter of just some people are better at dealing with social interaction, period. Like even with writing. I mean, when you're writing a blog or tweeting or whatnot, you have control over what you're going to say. You can edit it. You can, you know, make sure it's absolutely perfect. But there are some people who still don't do well with that, with the instant communication aspects of it. They'll post things and they go, oh, no, I shouldn't have posted that.
True.
And once it's on the internet, you can't get rid of it.
That's true. And that's why for the interviews, I always tell the authors that if they say something that they don't want on the internet forever, please let me know and I will cut it out of the interview and put it on the blackmail drive. Now, as far as newbie authors goes, I don't know what you're talking about there. I mean, as I stare at my Twitter thing and I see that I've got 21,000 tweets, I just think you're way off base there about newbie authors and Twitter spam.
That's it really depends on what your posts are. If all you're posting is my book came out, go read my book, I've got a review of my book on this site, you're going to annoy people. But if you've interspaced things well, you have a few posts about yourself and a few posts about books you've read or other things that you've seen on the internet or, you know, neat videos or whatnot you've seen, people are more forgiving about the amount of promotional stuff you put in. I mean, it's one thing that publishers don't have a problem with because everyone assumes that their sites are going to be promotional. Whereas with authors, you want more varied posts, I think.
Sure. Now, Jeff, you have a background that allows you a perspective on what has become, you know, old media as well as new media. So what's your take on this?
Well, I personally have always found it more enjoyable when it's in the form of either a forum. I always enjoy going to Harlan Ellison's Dining Pavilion and seeing him, you know, banter back and forth with fans. I also liked back when he was updating it, when Dan Simmons used to do his relatively regular blog where he would do longer form posting.
And obviously for the sake of our listeners, Harlan Ellison is best known as the creative consultant on Babylon 5.
That is correct.
That's a sad thing.
I find the longer form blogging and stuff like that, I find that I enjoy that more because I think it sets more of a tone and it's also something that has to be, it's an author when they're writing, you know, much more of a structure type thing, but that's just me. There are a lot of forums that have come up around certain authors. Warren Ellis has the excellent Whitechapel forum, which I go to all the time, which covers all kinds of stuff. There's a couple different comic book author and artist forums that I go to. And I find it interesting because two things occur. Number one, you get the fawning fans who go to it every day, and it sort of becomes a substitution for family and actual social interaction. But you also get the people that are genuinely interested in the progress of certain projects and stuff like that. And if nothing else, it is always wildly entertaining because you always get one or two true nut jobs. Believe it or not, fandom tends to generate crazy people. And
I don't think it's so much fandom that generates crazy people. I think it's the anonymity. The fact that no one's going to hold you to what you just said. That allows people to say things that they might not say in, you know, cultured conversation.
Yeah, but fandom was generating nut jobs before anonymity came up.
Well,
so, I mean, attracting
some nut jobs don't care if
they became fans. They just sort of latched on to fandom as their vehicle for nuttiness.
I would agree.
Larry, what were you trying to say?
I said some nut jobs don't care if they're anonymous or not. They're so... violently is probably not the right word, but they're so passionate about what they're reading or what they're into that, you know, they were nut jobs before anonymity came along.
Well, and really, I mean, fan is the short form of fanatic. Not necessarily fandom.
Yeah, it is. It is. But I think there's a connection that social media gives to certain fans where you can have a – for authors that are willing to take advantage of social media the way that it is right now, you can really have a one-on-one connection. I mean, that is how I met Paul Levinson, for example, who is frankly a good friend of mine now, was through he read my book, I read his book, we exchanged signed books, and I met him over MySpace, for Christ's sake, which is the only reason I was on MySpace is my 13-year-old son asked me if he could be on MySpace, and I said, only if I can be your friend and see everything that you do, because I'm frightened to death of what would happen out there. But I met Paul through a MySpace connection, and we exchanged books, and we read each other's books, and we liked it. And I've met him in person. We've had wine, we've had beer, we've had interaction, and it became the kind of friendship that you want outside of social media. I understand that doesn't happen with all social media author interactions. I understand that there are some that are just give and not take. Like Jessica said, there's a lot of people that just send. Yeah, and I think the authors that are pushing stuff out there, automatically without or robotically is probably a better word, without interacting with their audience, are missing a huge benefit. I've interacted with Paul. I've become decent friends with Jonathan Mayberry, though I've never met him in person. And we exchange what I would consider pleasantries, because I reviewed his book for SF Signal, and I had to interview him for SF Signal, and he just had a knee replacement, and I sent him a note, how was your knee replacement? And it's more personal. It can become anonymous, and it can become the bad part of the internet, where there's spam involved, and there's I really don't care who you are as a person as long as I can interact with you. But it can also become a good thing. It can also be a way to connect with somebody, even though you may be in Tomball, Texas, and they're in Philadelphia.
Larry, if I could ask, so who's the crazy person, you or Paul?
Well, when we drink wine, it's my wife, actually.
I'd also like to tell any crazy people listening to send your emails to Patrick Hester.
Good point. Let's get Patrick's full email address right now.
Yes, and that would be at Bad Day Studio.
Actually, no, we sent all the mail to John DiNardo this week. So.
Yes, all of John. John. The success of the Functional Nerds podcast, which John Neely and I do, is tied directly to the relationships that we have built on Twitter with authors. I mean, he first befriended Blake Charlton and Peter Brett and these folks on Twitter. And then, as I got involved and started talking to them, I start befriending them too. And then me being me, I just give them a hard time. Those are the relationships that have built that way. And I think as you move forward, the publishers are definitely realizing the power of Twitter. I mean, my God, Tor has 417,000 different Twitter accounts now.
Yeah.
One for each genre, and not even... not only just genres, but I think, for each letter of the alphabet, there's probably tor.com_A, tor.com_B, so on and so forth.
Patrick, that's part of the problem, actually. Jessica made the point very well. If you want to be an anonymous author and you want to spam everybody and assume that the spam is going to relate to 10, let's say I spam 100,000 people, and I think 10% of those are going to buy my book. So I'm spamming to get 1,000 copies of my books bought. That's frankly worthless. If I'm an author and I'm trying to make a connection with somebody to either make myself better as an author, or to frankly do what authors do, which is connect with an audience, then it's a perfect medium. And I find that there is a very black and white section of authors out there. There's the what I would consider the black section, like Jessica said, which is people that are, hey, read my book. Hey, and they don't respond to people either asking questions or providing constructive criticism, which is what I consider the whitelist authors.
But see, those people also, they don't get returning followers. I mean, you follow someone, and if there is no interaction, or if it's just links and it's just that, I mean, you're dead on Twitter. You're not going to go anywhere.
Well, but agreed. But if it's a publisher sponsored account, and I'll pick on one of my favorite authors. You know, if it's a Dan Simmons sponsored account, who is a fantastic author, you know, it's hard to get to the guy.
Gotcha. Okay.
If it's Paul, and Paul is a great author. I mean, Paul's got a lot of good books out. He's won the Locus Award. If the author gets in the middle of it and decides that that's where he's going to get feedback, and decides that's why he's in the game, so to speak, he can have a big impact.
Sure. Okay. Final thoughts, Jay Garman.
Social media does not make or break an author. But the bottom line is, the publishers are not, for all of our talk about publisher-sponsored accounts, not giving authors the same support they did 15 years ago, and it's on the author's shoulders to do it themselves. And the ones that were going to be good at it are going to be good at social media, and the ones that were going to be bad at it are going to be bad at social media. And this doesn't change that. It just lowers the barrier. We're going to find out faster that Orson Scott Card's a jerk than we would have previously.
Jessica.
I've never met Jay, and I love him already.
Jessica, final thoughts.
I think ultimately, because so many people are buying books online nowadays, having an online presence is necessary. If someone can go to Tor.com and see this really cool book, and you know, go to Amazon or Chapters or wherever they download books and buy them immediately, they're going to. And that's where authors are going to make their money in the future.
Gotcha. Jeff?
The only interaction I have with authors really is when I hear their voices in my head and I go out to do their bidding. So.
I was going to try to do a Carl Sagan voice, and then I decided not to. Larry, final thoughts.
I'm not sure how I can follow Jeff's thoughts.
Okay.
Nobody can follow my thoughts.
You know, without trying to sound too philosophical here, I believe that there are certain connections that you're supposed to make. And when I sit across the table from Paul Levinson and have a glass of wine with him, he was supposed to be my friend. And I think that the power of the internet is exploring people who you want to be connected with, and that you can explore certain ideas with, and if authors will find those connections, that they'll be as empowered and as enriched as we are.
Mm. Very cool. All right. Well, thanks everyone for coming on this week. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely.
And we'll see you next week. And actually, we're not quite done. Both Charles A. Tan and Lisa Pate Spindler, who couldn't be with us when we recorded, sent in their thoughts on the subject. Let's listen to each one in turn. First, Mr. Charles A. Tan.
Hi, this is Charles Tan. With regard to the topic, social media isn't good or bad per se. Like ebooks, it's changed in the industry. Some people will be able to take advantage of this opportunity, while others won't. For example, less popular authors have this chance. Build a steady fan base without a dedicated marketing staff. Just look at some self-published authors and podcasts, novelists. On the other hand, if you're too famous, too many fans querying or pestering you might distract you from the craft of writing. It's one thing, for example, to respond to one tweet, another to respond to 100. One thing to remember is that we're all different and unique. As Jeff Vandermeer mentioned in his book Life, it's about managing your involvement. Some authors are perfect for intimately interacting with fans. Others aren't. If you're the latter, delving too deep into social networking is a horrible idea. Anonymous authors can exist, although it's more difficult. A better question, though, is why you want to remain anonymous. Marketing-wise, it's usually better to be upfront, so that readers have an easier way of relating with the author. It's by no means the rule, however. Just look at KJ Parker. For a few years, Parker managed to keep her gender secret, and even in this day and age of social networking, Parker is an enigma, save for the author's fiction. My main point, though, is that social media can be a great marketing tool, but it is not by any means necessary, nor do authors have to involve themselves deeply with fans, especially if they're the type that gets cranky easily or have poor time management.
Hi, my name is Lisa Pate Spindler, science fiction author and blogger. You can find me at lisapatespindler.com, as also a contributing blogger to SF Signal. Okay, the first question was, is social media good for the book industry, publishers, and authors, and are the days of the anonymous author gone? I do think the days of the anonymous author are gone, but I think that what many people are still trying to wrap their minds around when it comes to social media is that social media, whether it's Twitter or Facebook or your blog, it's a conversation. It's an interaction. It's not a hard sell. And for authors, this means that your presence in social media has to be more than just, please buy my book. That, of course, needs to be there, I think. But you need to have a well-rounded personality. You need to have opinions that people, preferably those who your audience, belong to your audience, who read your book, want to know what you want to say about things. And a great example of this is John Scalzi, who started out blogging, and a lot of his published writings grew out of that. I also think with him as an example, he's found where his voice is in social media. I think he is on Twitter, but not very often. He's primarily a blogger, and that medium suits his voice. It suits what he has to say, and he has an incredible following. And people want to know what he thinks about things in science fiction publishing, other than just buy my book or what's the latest book project he's working on. Certainly that's what people want to know as part of everything else that he has to say. And I've tried to keep that in mind in my own writing career. I became a blogger before I was a published author, and I put myself out there as the science fiction fan that I am, and I wrote about topics very near and dear to my heart in romance, in science fiction, in movies, and all of that. And I have found people who share those opinions and want to have that conversation, and that's what I've tried to do. I think you could probably cut it there. I think that that's probably the main part of the answer to the question, and then you ask for final thoughts. So for my final thoughts, it would be, don't get on to social media unless you have something to say, unless you, want to interact with other people. If you want to be anonymous, then simply doing the hard sell and only talking to your audience, and only talking to them instead of interacting with them is really not going to get you a payoff. But if you can come across as a real whole person online, then people will flock to your website, to your Twitter feed, to your Facebook page, to see what you're saying and what's going on. And part of that will be, oh, by the way, my next book is coming out and whatever. but it's not the only message.
This week's interview is up next, and Karen Burnham took the reins on this one for me. This was one of the weeks when I wasn't feeling very well, and Karen stepped in and did an awesome interview. Here you go. It's with Gail Carriger.
So this is Karen Burnham here with the SF Signal podcast. Today we've got Gail Carriger, the author of Soulless, Changeless, and Blameless, the best bodice ripper, steampunk, urban fantasy, alt history, mystery series that you will ever read. Gail, we are happy to have you on.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So how are things going for you these days? It sounds like you've had a busy year with again, Soulless, I believe, came out in 2009, Changeless and Blameless, 2010, yes?
Yep. Yeah, all three of them came out within the space of a year, so it was pretty busy. October to October. And yeah, it's been a crazy 2010 for me. So I'm kind of looking forward to a little low-key time for a couple months before the next book comes out.
Ah, wonderful. And how are the next, I believe you said that you've said in various places that 5 books is what you're looking for this series?
Yep. Yeah, there's just 2 more. And I'm pretty firm about that. I'm not really a Jim Butcher kind of girl. I don't want to just keep writing the same characters. So I'll probably keep playing in the same world, but I am going to kind of end my main character story at 5. So I just handed in number 4. And I don't have time for a breather, so I've actually just started writing number 5. I'm 3 days into the last book.
Ah, congratulations.
Thanks.
It sounds like this is a world that's got a lot of potential. I was explaining actually to Ted Chang why I thought that your book was actually hard SF. And I have arguments for that, but the more I was explaining the universe, it feels like the more work and depth that you've put into it. I mean, it on the surface, these books are, you know, they're fun and they're funny and witty and adventurous, but it feels like you put a lot of work into the world building. Has that come across over the years?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's really sweet of you to say, but because yes, I do. I put a lot of thought and concentration into how the world is built. And I think most of it, and as with most writers, doesn't really get onto the page at all, and particularly with me because I do write comedy. But it's really nice when somebody kind of notices. I put a lot of thought into it, mainly because I'm really interested in alt history, and in my case, kind of re-explaining the history that is up to a point. So I put a lot of thought into that. And I think if you want to strengthen your argument that the sci-fi aspect for me is that I have no magic in my world. And so everything that is kind of supernatural or preternatural has to be explained by the Victorian science of the day. So it's science fiction in that everybody is playing by the same scientific rules. They just happen to be the rules of 1873.
Absolutely. That was pretty much my argument, was that, well, there's some religious language being used to describe the phenomenon they're seeing, as in people having great soul or no soul or somewhere in between. That's just a label that's being attached to a phenomenon that they're still investigating.
Yes, exactly. And that's because during this particular time period, legitimate scientists, were in fact trying to weigh the soul and determine the nature of the soul, because there wasn't the same kind of sort of bipolar segregation to science versus religion that we have in the modern age. Back then, it was still incorporated. Nobody saw that there was sort of a mutual exclusivity going on to any degree. So the scientists would use religious language because that was just part of their vocabulary.
Right, and that made sense. And the other thing I was thinking was how much electromagnetism at that time, from, say, the 1820s to the 1880s, I mean, when you had Gauss and Weber and Tesla and all these people who were making all these, Faraday, making all these discoveries for the first time, it was still kind of toys. They were still just playing with the concepts. They didn't really know how it was all going to fit together yet. And that's kind of where I felt like the characters were in the time you were writing.
Yes, and you've actually tapped onto something that is kind of comes out of my archaeology. And so this is sort of one of those little secrets which archaeologists sort of all know and accept, which is that when a new technology is introduced, and that new technology could be, you know, the smelting of iron, for example, it's almost always introduced as sort of a luxury novelty item. It doesn't leap fully formed into weaponry, for example, if we're talking about iron. It usually makes its first appearance as jewelry or as something really, really frivolous. And so to me, one of the sort of great beauties of this early industrial time period in the Victorian era is that you do get the most bizarre and frivolous little mechanical items and little inventions coming up, because that's kind of the new technology. That's sort of how it often develops. It often makes its way into the world in the most ridiculous ways. And so to me, that was kind of part of the comedy of exploring the Victorian era, is that they did have things like these little sippy cups that they had invented to, so that men could drink without getting anything on their mustaches and things like that. It's just so much fun. So if you do what I did, which is essentially I took Victorian science, I froze it in one time period, and I said, okay, let's assume that all of these crazy, really pseudoscientific ideas that they were exploring at this time period were true. Let's just make that assumption. Let's assume that the ether really did exist, and, you know, electromagnetism could bring a body back to life, those kinds of things. Then what would the world be like if those things were true and inventions that remained true to that science could really exist? And, of course, they're going to invent things like a pop-up monster parasol over their carriages, because what else would you do with early hydroponic, you know, that kind of a thing.
Well, and the James Bond parasol, I mean.
Yeah. Well, that's just me. I mean, because of the sort of status in British society that I'm exploring, which is sort of upper, very upper class, one of the few ubiquitous accessories that a lady would carry with her all the time, especially during the day, of course, was a parasol. And it's sort of the only accessory that's really large enough to make a good weapon as well. And so I basically took the parasol idea and just ran with it and said, okay, we're going to essentially Swiss Army knife the parasol. And my main character, who is kind of a little bit of a 007 kind of concept, carries around this essentially Swiss Army knife parasol.
Very handy.
Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely. Of course, being my character, her most common application is sort of just a blow to the head. She's a very kind of forthright person, so it has all of these nifty tricks. But most of the time, she's just bashing her way through things quite happily.
Well, and I noticed she was doing that even before she had the tricked out parasol.
Why mess with a good thing? It's worked for her before.
Exactly. And that brought up one thing. I know steampunk, of course, has become such a movement these days, and a lot of that has to do with costuming. I mean, you see, you know, the steampunk conventions. I know you've attended some of those. But I noticed your personal style seems to be more 1920s, 1940s.
Yeah, I'm kind of I've always been into rockabilly. I mean, we were talking earlier about swing dancing, and that's kind of one of my many passions. But that time period seems to really suit my body type, and I am really interested in fashion and in clothing, so I kind of settled into a kind of vintage-inspired look because it just seems to suit me best. But I do have quite the collection of Victorian costuming and steampunk costumes and stuff. I just don't... I'm not really a lifestyler. I prefer to sort of just bring it out and dress to the nines for events, and then the rest of the time kind of do my own thing. And part of that is, you know, I didn't want to sort of brand myself as an author completely as steampunk. I love writing steampunk, and there are some people who argue that my stuff really isn't steampunk at all. I tend to think of myself as steampunk, but, you know, to each their own. But I don't imagine that that's what I'm going to be doing for the next 30 years. So I kind of, you know, want to be able to write other things. I've been toying recently. I don't think I'm going to do it, but I have a kind of mini love affair with the idea of doing, as I did, kind of mock pseudo urban fantasy, but set in like suburban 1950s Mad Men type period. I just think it would just be really comical to try and get vampires and werewolves to fit comfortably into the advertising world in the 1950s.
Seems like the vampires would have an edge.
I think they might. I think they might.
And that actually sort of brings me to another question I had. When I described you at the top of the podcast, or the books rather, as, you know, this and that and that and the other thing, and you mentioned that some people think it's steampunk and some people don't. Have you had any trouble with marketing or selling these novels because they do kind of cross so many genre and subgenre boundaries? Have you had an agent go, wow, I love this, but I have no clue how to market it?
Well, actually, I thought that. So when I originally wrote the first book, I thought, well, you know, I pretty much wrote it because this is all things that I wanted to read in one place, you know, because I like urban fantasy, but it's a little too dark for me. I'm really kind of a P.G. Woodhouse, Terry Pratchett, Douglas Adams type, so I wanted something that had a lot of fun and farce and comedy in it, and I really miss the comedies of manners. So I was like, okay, so I'll take this urban fantasy and I'll put it into Victorian London, and we'll make it a comedy of manners, and then kind of as an organic side effect of looking at what scientists were like during the Victorian times and how they would react if they had vampires and werewolves and ghosts around, the steampunk kind of came out of that. So I had this kind of alternative technology as well. So I had all these components. And I was like, oh, this is going to be great. And I wrote the book. And I was like, but nobody's going to buy it. You know, I'm just having fun. No one is going to buy it because it is so many different genres. And of course, as a professional writer, you are writing to sell to an editor. You're not really writing for a readership at all. So, you know, I could imagine people enjoying the book and wanting to read it, but they weren't the first ones, at least, who had to buy the book. An editor had to love it and want to buy it. And I was like, nobody's going to, I mean, even if an editor adores it, they'll never clear it through their marketing team because nobody will know what kind of cover to put on it or even where it goes on the shelf. So I just assumed, I sent the book out and I just assumed I was going to start collecting the usual pile of rejection letters. So I was really genuinely floored when an editor called me up and was like, I love it. I want to buy it. I was like, sure. Like, do you have the right number? And when I had my first sort of sit-down meeting with Orbit and their marketing team, which in those days was one person, it became clear, and don't tell Orbit, but it became pretty clear that they really did not have any idea what they were, how they were going to market it. And so they bought it, and they were like, we love it, but we really just have no clue. So everybody was a little confused as to, and I still get, periodically, I'll get bookstores who will be like, who will contact me on Twitter or something, and be like, where should we shelve your books? I'm like, right at the front on the end cap would be fine.
if you had to pick one place.
And periodically I'll go in and I'll find them in the horror section or, you know, tucked away in the romance section or with the other, most have settled sort of comfortably into putting them with urban fantasy in the sci-fi fantasy section. But it has been contended, and there are certainly many people who are like, where do we put it? And I keep just telling them, you know, don't worry about it. The readers will find it. And by and large, just if you don't take the book seriously, then you'll enjoy it. That's kind of my main rule.
I have to admit, I've enjoyed it, both taking it not seriously just as some of my enjoyment reading, and then when I was forced to you know, step up and really get into it, I was like, wow, this really holds up, even in a deeper sense. And I have to admit, it's one of those things, I tend to be one of the least feminine women I know, and I just love these books.
Aw, thank you.
Yeah, I'm an engineer, and I do all these things, and I just love the whole thing.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I love Alexia. I love the whole adventure comedy thing. I just feel like sometimes the genre doesn't have enough really good comedy.
Well, it's an interesting point. One of the reasons that I wrote these as comic is because that was what I wanted. But another reason was that prior to that, any short stories that people had bought from me tend to be comic. And I kind of knew that most of the time, editors are always hurting for lighter or more comedic fare in the sci-fi fantasy world. They both kind of want it. It's sort of a love-hate relationship because they kind of want it, but then again, they don't take it seriously, of course, because it's comedy. But another thing I did notice is that there are very, very few women writers who write comedic stuff. I mean, many, many authors will have comedic elements, but true comedy authors like Terry Pratchett or Christopher Moore or Douglas Adams are all, or Jasper Fjord are men. So I was like, I think there's a niche. I was like, I'm going to carve myself a niche. Because I love to laugh, and it seems to me that in sort of economic dark times, I would like to hope that other people want to laugh too. And I think part of the reason that the books have been embraced is because of the comedy. Like, people just really like it. That I'm not going to do all those things that they tell you have to do for dark fantasy, right? I'm not going to kill my darlings. I'm not going to torture anybody. Nobody's going to get raped. You know, that's just not going to happen in my books. They're always going to be lighthearted. And you can kind of bank on that and know that if you pick one of them up, you know, something sad may occur, but really it'll all be fine in the end and everybody will have tea, you know?
Right, and I appreciate that. And I mean, that allows you to have characters like Lord Akeldama. And exactly. How do you pronounce that, by the way?
You pronounce it the way I pronounce it, which is Akeldama. My British reader for the audiobooks pronounces it Akeldama, which is going to burn her in the fourth book. But because I pronounce it Akeldama. You would have to go to, you know, some native Arab speaker to find out how it's appropriately pronounced. But that's how I pronounce it.
Okay. And I was wondering, when you have flamboyant characters like Madame Lefaux and Lord Akeldama and, well, you know, Lyle and Connell, all of them, how do you avoid letting some of them just run away with the book? I feel like Akeldama, in every scene he's in, just wants to pick up the whole book and run away with it.
He does, but can you imagine having to read an entire book of him? I mean, it would be totally intolerable. But yes, they do. I certainly have characters, and I am one of those authors who says, you know, sometimes my characters hijack my scenes and there's nothing I can do about it. And Lord Akeldama in particular will, you know, enter stage right and there's nothing I can do about it. He's just gonna, like, sweep away with the scene. He's really hard to control. But usually he kind of knows what's going on, and there's a reason that he's sweeping away with the scene. But one of the kind of conceits of the book is that my main character, Alexia, is, because of her nature in my universe, is so very practical and so very grounded that she's sort of the perfect straight man.
Yeah.
So she can have all of these totally outrageous characters kind of fluting and sipping and floating around her and entering in one side of the scene and leaving the other, and something explodes with sparkles or whatever. And she can make some sort of droll or snarky or witty remark because that's her personality. And so she kind of brings the story back and drives the movement of the plot by being the grounding element to all of these crazy, outrageous characters around her. Although, that said, she does have her temper, and she does tend to sort of bluster in guns blazing without really thinking ahead. that's kind of part of the fun of writing these books, is that I do get to play with intrinsically comedic, almost caricatures, and play them off of my main character, who isn't any of those things.
That makes a lot of sense. And then another thing I was wondering, so Akeldama's been there since the first book, and he is very flamboyant, and he's very openly gay, even in the sort of 1870s Victorian era. And Alexia has always been fine with that. But when Madame Lefaux shows up in the second book, and pretty much all the readers can tell pretty much right off the bat, oh, she's gay too, Alexia is just floored. She has no idea. And I was wondering, did that come out of your historical research?
To a certain degree, yeah. I mean, part of the reason I think Alexia is floored is that Madame Lefaux makes a pretty clear pass at her, and Alexia is kind of like, I don't know what to do. there's a number of components to that, one of which is Lord Akeldama and sort of the foppish pink of the dandy, essentially, of the Victorian era, was a kind of stereotypical caricature of that time period, and to a certain degree everybody kind of knew or would have known that there was an alteration in sexuality implied in that, but nobody would have said anything or acknowledged it outright. It's a little bit the way the British were about public school, which of course is private school, but you know, where boys will be boys, you know, like, well, you know, they'll experiment and that's the way it is, and we just don't talk about that or really think about that or anything. You could go to jail for homosexuality and if somebody accused you publicly, but so long as everybody gets a stiff upper lip and mind their own business and drank tea with their little finger in the air the way you were supposed to, nobody really did anything. But women, of course, are a different scenario entirely, and there was definitely an underground women's homosexual movement going on in England, but it was very much more secretive, and that of course has to do with just the way society was built and the way it, you know, women had much less autonomy and much less freedom of movement, and so they really couldn't carry on without some kind of liberty. So, you know, you had to be a widow or something like that in order to to be able to explore any avenues, but even then it was pretty frowned upon. So I'm not, I mean, I don't deal with a lot of the dark underbelly of Victorian society. I do write comedy, and so I pretty much ignored bigotry and racism and sexism and all the things that were evil about that time period, and there were a lot of them. And one of those is kind of ignoring the way, you know, sexual politics actually would have been at the time period. And I kind of justify that to myself, at least, by arguing that the immortals approach all of these things differently. So they not only approach living, because they are immortals, so they don't have the same concerns that a mortal person might have, but they also approach kind of sexual exploration and food and clothing and hedonism differently, because they have the luxury of being able to explore it as much as they would like and in any way that they would like, because no one can really do anything to them. So, and Lord Aquilama has kind of taken that to its height of extravagance. However, you know, like I am open to surprising people. So Lord Aquilama may very well have had a young lady in his past or in his future. You never know. I think he's pretty much open to anything.
And that's why we look forward to books number 4 and 5. But that sounds like a good place to wrap this up. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been so much fun.
Hold on. Before you go, tell everybody your websites and where they can find you online.
Oh, yes. Oh,
of course. You can find me at www.gailcarriger.com. That's GAILCARRIGER. Or you can type that into Google, and that's the first thing that will come up is my website. But I'm also on Twitter and Facebook and all over the web. So feel free to friend me or follow me or whatever.
And there you have it, our interview with Gail Carriger. Thanks to Karen Burnham for shouldering that interview for me. I really appreciate that. If you'd like to leave us any comments, feel free. Our voicemail line is 720-277-9082. And as always, you can just leave us tons and tons of comments on the post on sfsignal.com. We'll be back next week. Thanks, everybody. And thanks for listening. And we'll see you next week. Bye.